today. Guardian columnist Francis Ryan on the treatment of disabled people in an era of austerity. And mass protests in Hong Kong over a controversial extradition law.
What do we want? Civil rights! When do we want them? Now!
In the late 1980s and the early 1990s, many disabled people said they were tired of being treated as charity cases and called instead for the state to step in and cement their rights in law.
Actually gets to supporting us in a really concrete way by pressurising the government, by making sure we get our legislation, then, you know, that's when it stops. When accessible buses are going to be always accessible, all of them, and there's a plan, that's when we can stop doing this.
People took to the streets with placards calling for an end to discrimination. Some in wheelchairs chained themselves to buses and trains to demand access to public transport. And then in 1995, finally, came the Disability Discrimination Act.
It was really the first time that disabled people's civil rights in Britain had been enshrined in law.
Guardian columnist Francis Ryan says it was the start of huge improvements for disabled people. But then, in 2010, things changed.
If you really cannot work, we will always look after you.
As David Cameron became Prime Minister, arguing for the big society and ushering in an era of state austerity.
But if you can work and you refuse to work, we will not let you live off the hard work of others.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, how disabled people are still being hurt by austerity.
I was born in 1985. With a general muscle weakness. It was a rare condition, and I was diagnosed when I was about two. By around the 1990s, it was a really sort of positive time, I think, for disabled people in Britain, because for the first time, we were having basic rights enshrined in law. So before I was born, all the way really up to the late 70s, conditions for disabled people in Britain were still really steeped in deep inequality.
When did you first get a wheelchair?
So I needed a wheelchair really from the first years of primary school, but I was using what was essentially a giant buggy, and I got my first proper wheelchair when I was about seven, and that was provided by a charity called WizKids.
So you had to get that from a charity, not from the NHS?
Yeah, and that's was a really common thing. You know, it's a few thousand pounds to get a wheelchair, and it was only through a great charity that I was able to get my first chair, which was a huge, you know, huge impact for me. It meant that I could be a bit more, you know, normal at school.
So I'm interested in this kind of idea that people were being treated as charity. You know, you had to go to a charity to get your wheelchair instead of the NHS. In your book, you write about this protest outside an ITV telethon in 1992. It was trying to raise money for disability charities, and there's this clip of the presenter, Chris Tarrant, defending the idea.
I don't believe that the disabled people in this country don't gain from the vast sums of money that are raised. I mean, they must do. Their lives, I mean, the whole thing surely is to make their lives better and happier.
What was people's objection?
So a major issue for disabled people throughout Britain at that time was really getting the state to take responsibility for providing us with support that enabled us to live lives like any other people. The relationship between charity and disabled people was key to that. The idea that instead of social security or social care being the important factor to enabling disabled people to live full lives, that it should come from, you know, sort of a charity tin or fundraisers. And we were still having to rely on this real piecemeal, patronising, though often well-intended, charity drives.
And then in 1995, the tone really changed. The state stepped forward with a piece of landmark legislation, the Disability Discrimination Act, to cement rights in law. What changes did that bring about?
So really basic things like enabling us to have the legal right to access public transport, or to have access to employment for a boss not to be legally allowed to sack me if I become a wheelchair user. And that came about through decades of incredible campaigning from disabled people.
So Frances, you studied politics and you became really interested in inequality, and you started writing about that, but also focused heavily on disability.
I think as the years went on and I started to work at The Guardian, it was also a case of representation. I was very aware that I was one of the few working class disabled people in the British media. And I think you feel a sense of responsibility that when things are happening that affect people like you, in your aware voice, if you like, in the British media, you've got a bit of a responsibility to start doing some coverage that is fair towards people like you.
So in 2012, you were in your early 20s and you were here in King's Place, The Guardian's headquarters. And it was an incredibly optimistic summer. There was the Olympics and then the Paralympics. And you covered the opening ceremony. I've read what you said at the time. You said no one knew what to expect the night that disability would flood onto our screens. Do you remember watching it and how you felt?
The thing that really struck a lot of disabled people, I know it did me, was it's so rare when you see a majority of disabled people on screen.
The Paralympic Games are all about transforming our perception of the world.
You're so used to seeing at best sort of one or two token disabled people, but that sense that, yeah, this is a good time for disabled people in Britain, and, you know, being pushed forward rather than being shut away and hidden.
And Eleanor Siblings takes gold and another world record.
And it was a stage for the Prime Minister at the time, David Cameron, who was the father of a disabled child, and he said the event would inspire people and change views on disability. He said Britain was a trailblazer.
We can be proud of the fact we've been something of a trailblazer in Britain, passing equality legislation, disability legislation, funding disability sport properly.
It was an infuriating thing to watch him say, because we knew very well that David Cameron and his colleagues had a few months earlier been setting in motion a political agenda that had ushered in unprecedented demolition of Britain's safety net for disabled people.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now have the victory ceremony for the men's 400 metres.
And Frances, I'll always remember that moment that Cameron's Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne, who'd been making a lot of the changes you were talking about in his budget, was introduced at the Paralympic Games. And there was this incredibly loud boo, and he kind of smiled awkwardly.
First boos that we've heard all week at the Paralympic Stadium.
It was that sense of just rank hypocrisy, the fact that people like David Cameron and George Osborne could use the Paralympics as a way to show, you know, what great, compassionate Conservatives they were.
And at this time, you as a journalist started to travel around the country and you started to meet people with disabilities. What type of people did you meet?
One woman that really stood out for me was Susan, who I talked to in 2013, 2014. She's a wheelchair user. She has multiple health problems.
Oh, my God. You really want me to list it all? Basically, I've got GI dysmotility, diverticulosis, asthma, COPD, osteoarthritis, osteoporosis. I'm now being investigated for multiple sclerosis.
Economically, she'd always struggled to pay the bills because she was too ill to hold down a job anymore. But because of these benefit cuts, she was no longer having enough coming in through her social security to live on. She was telling me as early as 2014 that she couldn't afford to use her oven anymore. She couldn't afford to put her heating on.
Sometimes my dinner is beans on toast because it's all I can afford. And that's if I'm lucky. But most of the time, my carer will bring me in food when she can afford it. Certain medication you've got to buy yourself. Pads, incontinent pads, I have to contribute. Council tax, I'm paying £16 a month now. These are the sort of things that politicians don't take into account. I think I'm just used to it now. I can't think of another word. But I'm just used to all the crap being thrown at me.
I was just struck by the fact that she told me, you know, things haven't got better. They've actually just got worse and worse. And, you know, Susan is just one of, you know, literally hundreds and hundreds of people that I've spoken to over the last 7 years who are going through this. And that's just a small snapshot of the hundreds of thousands of disabled people who are living, I think, in conditions that you literally wouldn't wish on an animal.
So you described how politicians began rolling back the rights of disabled people. What policies were they introducing that you felt did that?
So there was a real speed with these policies that were coming in. It was the fact that, for example, disability living allowance that had been the social security measure that paid for the extra costs of disabilities was abolished and replaced with personal independence payments that was designed to be a tougher test and to remove support from around 500,000 disabled people.
The Work and Pension Select Committee says some of the reforms to the disability living allowance could mean people lose out on the money they rely on to meet their needs.
Measures like the Fit for Work tests that New Labour had brought in were being brought in for all disabled people on out-of-work sickness benefits.
The government's Fit to Work tests are leaving a number of disability benefits claimants with permanent mental health issues.
Other measures like the bedroom tax.
The UK has found a cheaper way to deal with the housing crisis. The so-called bedroom tax means...
which penalised hundreds of thousands of disabled people who needed spare rooms for anything from storing medical equipment to having carers in. We were seeing the beginning of billions of pounds of cuts to social care support.
And obviously you've been covering this ever since then. What was the total cost of the cuts?
So very early, around 2013, it was estimated that disabled people would lose around £28 billion worth of support. So research shows that disabled people have been hit 9 times harder than other people by cuts. And if you're severely disabled, that means you've been hit around 19 times harder than other people.
And the impact of austerity hitting disabled people so disproportionately has led to protests back on the street.
No ifs, no buts, no disability cuts.
People are really upset and angry, aren't they?
Even if you're in work and you're earning a decent wage, on average, disabled people have about £500 worth of extra costs per month. And if you're severely disabled, that can be as much as £1,000 a month. So there's huge costs, anything from, you know, saving for a wheelchair to extra heating or specialist food or taxis because you can't get on a bus. So we're having to face, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pounds extra costs on top of things like, you know, rent and utilities that everyone else has to pay. So they're really crucial pieces of social security that when you take that away, very easily pushes people with disabilities into, you know, poverty very, very fast.
On the PIP assessment, my carer helped me out. We sent in 40 sheets of all my medical conditions. We got the letter through within a matter of 7 days, being told that we would have someone visiting. And the lady that came sat for an hour and went through everything. Have you got proof of this? Have you got proof of that? Hold on, you've got my consultant's letters sitting in front of you. When she left, she leant over, held my hand. She said to me, I only let genuine people through. I waited 4 weeks. That was like a lifetime to me because I'm thinking if they take away that, then that's it.
And you've described that as the ultimate death knell of the welfare state.
I think that absolutely Britain has long told us that we have not only a well-funded welfare state, but even in so-called tough economic times, that disabled people and people with long-term sickness will be, at the absolute minimum, the people that will always be protected. But I think when you are in a position where even people who are severely ill and disabled are the ones who are taking these incredible cuts to their living standards, you are very much seeing that the welfare state has been stripped back in a way that I think few of us could ever imagine we would be in such a so-called modern and wealthy nation.
And David Cameron, of course, had all that rhetoric about the big society.
The big society, is it a dramatic transfer of power, as David Cameron says, from Whitehall to the people, or is it really about saving the government money?
In some senses, it felt like a shift back to the pre-1995 language of charity over the state. Do you think his government deliberately targeted the disabled?
I think as part of the austerity measures, there was this really sneaky perception shift, if you like, of what sort of people disabled people were. This idea that instead of being sort of just normal everyday people who need some support from the state, it was a sense that we were suddenly drains on the public purse, that we were an expense that we needed to cut. It was really mainstream rhetoric. It was, you know, we heard cabinet ministers, whether it's Ian Duncan Smith.
The benefit system has created pockets of worklessness where idleness has almost become institutionalized in the sense that there is little other scope for people to be other than in that state.
Or in an estimate of A.
Can you get dressed?
So,
can
okay,
you feed
so,
yourself? But, can you walk around? And this on money goes to support that.
On that basis, what you're saying is a lot of people on the benefit at the moment don't deserve it.
I never said that at all, and I would never
talk
say
in
that.
You know, work shy disabled people who just, you know, couldn't bother to go to work.
And was that working? I mean, again, you write about this idea of a simple and effective message, that it's not a global economic crash that has caused a recession, but the so-called bloated welfare bill covering the needs of supposedly disabled people. It was not high private rents, insecure jobs or low wages that was the root of people's problems, but their disabled neighbour living an easy life on benefits. Did you see evidence that that message was cutting through?
I think it was hugely effective. I think it was the way that this rhetoric was tied to actual policies that were coming through that were so effective. So we saw the rollout of fit for work tests, for example, that really started to push people who were quite clearly too ill or disabled to work off out of work sickness benefits. And that was really enabled by this rhetoric that was being pushed through statements by the cabinet and through sections of the right-wing press, when the public are repeatedly told that there are hordes of disabled people who aren't really disabled, who are faking it in order to get, you know, an easy life on benefits. It becomes so much easier for governments to pull support through policies like fit for work tests from disabled people.
And what do you think the ministerial motivation was? Because, for example, Ian Duncan Smith, who's made some of the comments that you find quite so offensive, would argue that a fit for work test is about saying to people who are disabled that we can give you something that might be motivational, that we can help support you into the type of work that you can do, and not say just because you've got a disability, there's no work that you can do.
I think that was the real issue, isn't it? It's this idea that motivation is what's lacking in disabled people, that if we just tried a bit harder, then suddenly we'd be able to do anything. And it shows just a complete lack of awareness of what sickness and disability is actually like.
And government advertising on this was pretty patronising.
So how does it work? Well, let's use Bob as an example. Within 2 working days, a fit-for-work health professional will give him a ring. Bob chats about his health, but also his other concerns. A fit-for-work assessment is made, and further help is signposted. Already, Bob is starting to feel more supported.
Do you just not think that these fit-for-work tests are getting people into suitable jobs?
We know from the statistics that are coming out of fit-for-work tests that they are a failing system.
With close support from his fit-for-work health professional, GP, and employer, Bob gets back to work. That's fit for work in action.
The questions they're asked, such as, you know, can you lift this above your head? Can you pick up a £1 coin? Are so far removed from the reality of disability and how that applies to the labour market. Those sort of questions have no basis in reality.
And in 2018, Theresa May announced that austerity was over. Is this government any better for disabled people?
We can use sort of phrasing like austerity is over. But actually, what disabled people have experienced is that there has been no change. And over the next few years, I think for a lot of disabled people, if there isn't major investments, if we don't have rapid change at the social security system, that sort of hardship will only continue. And it is a case of really having, I think, at this point in Britain, to ask a question of, well, what is life going to be like for disabled people in Britain over the next 10, 20 years? Because if we genuinely want Britain to be a global leader in disability rights, if we genuinely want disabled people to be equal members of society, we are going to have to ask serious, difficult questions about what we actually have to do as a country in order to achieve that. And right now, we are seeing rights roll back rather than progress being made.
That was Guardian columnist Frances Ryan, who has spent her journalistic career exposing the impact of austerity on those most in need. Her new book, Crippled, A Damning Exposé of Britain's Treatment of Disabled People, is out today. If you're affected by anything you heard on today's episode and want to talk to somebody, you can contact the Samaritans on 116 123. Coming up, what has brought hundreds of thousands of people out onto the streets in Hong Kong? Now, Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam has said she will not scrap a controversial new plan to allow extradition of suspects to mainland China for the first time, despite mass protests. Supporters of the law say it will prevent the semi-autonomous city of Hong Kong from becoming a criminal refuge. But critics fear Beijing will use it to extradite political opponents to China, where their legal protections cannot be guaranteed. The Guardian's Helen Davidson is in Hong Kong, where organisers claim that a million people have taken to the streets.
Last Tuesday, around 180,000 people gathered in Victoria Park in Hong Kong, and that was for the vigil commemorating the Tiananmen Square massacre. I mean, it was the 30th anniversary this year, so that was always going to be a really big event. But the opposition to this extradition bill, which has been really increasing over the last few months in particular, it was also a really heavy presence at the vigil as well. You know, it was a reminder of the democracy that they hold on to here in Hong Kong and what oppression in China and by China can mean. The extradition bill would allow for case-by-case extraditions to a number of regions that Hong Kong doesn't currently have arrangements with, and this includes mainland China. And the obvious concern that people have is that China's legal system and justice system is not considered to be very free, that it's not considered to be very fair. Whereas Hong Kong is very proud of its justice system, and it's seen as one of its assets as a diplomatic and financial hub. In the words of the activists who are pushing against this bill, the law will legitimise Chinese abduction. They're looking at the multiple cases of disappearances and renditions by the Chinese government of people in other countries to get them back to mainland China and to face charges of, you know, various different things, which are ultimately seen as being retribution for their political opposition and their political activism against China. No one really trusts that Hong Kong's reassurance that they will never hand over someone for political reasons. No one really trusts that. So, you know, it's a real fear among people in Hong Kong, and that was something that came across a lot when I was speaking to people at the protest yesterday. I went down there about half an hour before it was starting, and I really struggled to get there. You know, I was only walking a couple of blocks, but it would have taken maybe an hour. The streets were full, and it was a sea of white T-shirts everywhere you looked. Social media was full of videos of jammed up metro stations, of ferries that were filling up and not being able to get on. And everyone around me was, you know, walking very purposefully towards Victoria Park. People are obviously frustrated, but it was incredibly peaceful. People were so determined that this be a really peaceful event. There was at one point someone tried to agitate the crowd, saying, you know, let's jump over onto the street. And people called him back saying, no, we've got to do this right. it got very late, and there are thousands and thousands of people still trying to get into the area around the Legislative Council. But at midnight, their permit for a protest expired and police told them that they had to move on. There were some key groups that said, no, we're going to stage a sit-in. We're going to be here until Wednesday. You can't move us. This refusal escalated into clashes between police and protesters. It was quite violent. There were barricades and bottles thrown. There were several people injured, including police officers. And the riot police were really massing, and they were rushing at these protesters quite systematically to push them further and further up the road, you know, 100 metres, and then 10 minutes later, another 100 metres. It was quite intimidating, I think. I mean, no one was really putting up much of a resistance at that point because the officers were outnumbering protesters, you know, at least 5-1. Hong Kong's Legislative Council is going to debate the bill again on Wednesday, and it's looking like it will pass. In the last couple of years, pro-democracy legislators have been expelled from Parliament. They are a significant minority, but they are a minority, and they just don't have the numbers to push against this bill. And because of that, I think people have geared up, and we are looking now at more protests on Wednesday and further into the future as well.
That was Helen Davidson. My thanks to her and to Francis Ryan. Today's episode was produced by Chika Ayres and Rachel Humphreys. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.